Thank you. My name is Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. And it really is nice to be here. But these guys down front are laughing and snorting, and they're having so much fun. I think I'm going to look over you guys. We've been back there giggling, so... I'm so pleased to be here, and Marge and George and Lindsay, thank you so much. I'm a little heartsick that I have Ken's spot because he's a friend of mine, and if you could, in your moment of meditation before the prayer tonight, just wing a little bit of love to him because his son is very ill, and he could use it, I'm sure. But I never make a list of people that I have to thank, but there's been so many here. I mean, Billy fixed my shoes. Pat gave me 2 welcomes here and presents and gifts, and seeing John and Mary Emma again has been just so much fun. And Helen and Rebecca, who I met in Edisto, it's so nice to see those smiles again. And then there's Lynn and Sid, and I really know that if we would have hung together for a while, we would have gotten in a little more trouble than what we were getting into trouble yesterday in the hotel. But that's sobriety for me, is having a lot of fun, and I always wanted to be taller, so that's just kind of... I imagine when I drank I was taller, so thank you. And just, Robert... has been just the best host. He picked me up at the airport at 4:30 in the morning. I took the night flight because I thought I was speaking last night. And he has been just a true gentleman. And he also drives a Harley, and today we got to go out to see, on the bike, a friend of mine that was very viable and full of life and bringing me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. 17 years and 11 months and a few days ago. And she is dying of this disease and dying of cancer. And that was an experience that I shared not just with Robert, but with Hal and Laura. And they brought me a lot of love because it was a very hard thing to do. I haven't seen this woman in probably 15 years. And she used to drag me around to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous when I had a broken jaw and my nose was off to the side. I had nothing but torn jeans and blue jeans, and she just loved to take me to Beverly Hills to meetings. That's what she used to love to do. And she'd put me right by the coffee pot and count how many people would shake my hand. And I just owe her my life. And so it was a real experience to share that with Hal and Laura and Robert today, and I got my Hal's Angels shirt, and I'm part of the group now. But I have had such a lot of love here. I mean, I've had so many laughs. I mean, I have had more laughs with Alberta and John here than I ever did in L.A. So it's nice to see them and to hear Kathy today. It always scares me when I identify with an Al-Anon speaker. Makes me a little nervous, but you know, I know that just add alcohol and we were the same. And I have really gotten a lot of love and a lot of hugs, and I can't tell you what I'm going to bring back to LA with me. It'll be more than my heart can stand. So thank you. Thank you for helping me feel closer to my God. I was born in the great state of Iowa, the great flood state of Iowa, and that was my first resentment going into life, when I realized that's where I was from. And it was always never enough for me. My home state wasn't enough for me. My hometown wasn't old. I was out on a country road, and they were passing around Schlitz beer and Canadian Club. And I'll tell you, I sat on the hood of that 57 Chevy with my knees too big and my legs too skinny and flat-chested, and looking at all the girls that have reached puberty that had. Thank you. without getting into too much trouble because I was a good smoke screen artist. I don't know about you, but I was good at pulling the smoke screen. And I was so involved in activities nobody would ever think that I was getting drunk during lunch hour and getting drunk before cheerleading and getting drunk as before I was a head major in the band and I had to remember the whistles and what we were doing. And I was getting drunk all the time. And I slid into college and Dad was buying and it was party time. And it was the late 60s and there was a lot going on. And I seemed to gravitate from the nice little sorority I had joined and the nice people in the education department that I had started to befriend to the fine arts students, the ones that were creating and looking for truth. And I had a natural ability at art. I always had have. And I started to paint and I started to drop out of those other classes and drop out and tune in is what I was doing. And it was the late 60s, and there was a lot going on, and I began my search for truth. I had started to get a fake ID, and I drank in the bars. I always had my wine bottle with me wherever I was, and I began to smoke pot and take diet pills and take that LSD looking for truth and whatever you had. I mean, I don't know, the 80s were the just say no generation, you know, Miss Reagan did that for us, and the 60s were just say thanks, you know, and we just took whatever it was, you know, whatever was there. And I was always one in each hand, and I would put it in my mouth and wash it down with my wine, and off we go, you know. But I'll tell you, if drugs would have done it for me, I'd be in another program. Alcohol is what did it for me. Alcohol always did it for me. These were just like M&Ms with the main course, you know. But I had a big fight with my father because he brought the priest down to talk to me because they were beginning to wonder. I began to look funny. I began to dress funny. I began to have funny-looking friends. My grades were dropping. I was wearing bells around my ankles and dressing in antique clothing and not eating. And I had a suicide attempt, and so I thought I'd write home and tell them about it. You know, I don't know. Not about my new art project, but about my suicide attempt. So my father became concerned, and he brought the family priest down. And the priest and I went out to dinner with my dad that night, and we got so drunk that it was sinful is what it was. I remember my father standing there as we went to the student union afterwards, and I'm introducing him to my Black Panther friends and my SDS friends and all the comrades at arms in this school. And the priest is becoming a comrade, you know, that evening. And we're drunk as can be, and my father is just standing aghast in the background looking at all this because he thought that, you know, maybe this religion could fix it for me. And I shortly after that had a big fight with my father, and I didn't mince words with my dad. I told him exactly what I felt and how I felt about things and about him and his generation, et cetera, et cetera. And I ended up running away to New York because he stopped paying for school, you know, and I had to go to work, and so I thought I'd go to New York. And I'm 19, 20 years old, and I really should have the world by the tail, but I'm taking crystal methadrine so I can not miss anything. I'm drinking in the bars until 4 in the morning. I'm having the bumps on my head read every Friday by the phrenologist, you know, just in case a new bump would grow once during that week, he could tell me about my life and where I'm going, you know. They're easy to spot in the bar because they wear the white turbans and they're white, you know, in the dark corners of the bar. And I was doing palmistry and I Ching and tarot cards, and then I would put on my little suit and go to work in an advertising agency in the Pan Am building. And I would eat handfuls of orange sunshine, which was finding truth type of LSD, and I'd drink 2-hour lunches, and I would close my door and hallucinate a while and look for truth. And I did this over and over again for 9-10 months, and I got mugged, and I was happy he came because I had been waiting for him. I was so paranoid. I knew he was coming, and I would thank the mugger for happening. I thanked him for coming. And I was having this paranoia schizophrenia going on, and I couldn't ride subways. I had anxiety attacks all the time. And after 10, 11 months in the city, I got tired. You know, I hadn't found truth, or if I did, I lost it. And it was time to move on. And I called my father, And we're good. Alcoholics are good. We can talk our way back in at least once. You know, I used to hear people talk about their way back into the big bed. Well, you know, I talked my way back into college one more time with my father, and I had a free ride again. But something had changed. You know, I went back to those art classes, and I went back to those friends, and it didn't seem the same anymore. And I would sit down in front of a canvas, and I wouldn't be able to create. I would sit down with a sketch pad, and nothing came out anymore. And that was a part of me that brought me joy, brought you joy, brought me joy. It was a part of me. It wasn't my sister. It wasn't my brother. It was me. And it was gone now, and I didn't understand that that was one of the big pieces of my soul that I had already given up for this disease called alcoholism. I gave up lots of pieces of my soul as I walked the road of alcoholism freely. Just freely, because alcohol did more for me than art could ever do. Alcohol was number one. It was becoming the king of my life. And I didn't know that, so I was depressed that semester, and I didn't really go to very many classes, and my father and I had another big fight, and I ended up in Colorado. Now, I don't know I'm taking geographics. I just know I read a cowboy novel, and it sounded like a good idea. And I went off to Aspen, Colorado to become a cowgirl, and I worked at an equestrian restaurant. That's as close as I got. And I had a good time there, though, you know? And one day walked this guy that looked like Bob Dylan. He looked just like Bob Dylan. And I don't know about you, but if you know, you have to seize the day. And there he was. He was in front of me. And this man ordered a chocolate milkshake to go. And I remember I made two chocolate milkshakes to go. And I took off that waitress uniform and the apron, not the whole uniform. And I put it on the counter. And I told my boss I'm going to take some time off. And he said, well, you're fired. I said, well, I quit. You know, that was to become a habit. But I got in the car with this guy, and I said, hi, Bob, where are we going? And he said, California. And I said, let's go. And I came to California for the first time that way. And I'm not really sure if it was Bob Dylan or not, but, you know, I got here, and he sang good, and maybe he was. I don't know. But I ended up at a commune in Huntington Beach where they panhandled for a living. They either did the welfare route or panhandling. And I don't know anything about any of this, and I tried to go get welfare, and I told the truth, so they denied me, and so they put me out there to go panhandling, and I have no self-esteem, and I really don't know that. I just know that I end up with 50 cents after 4 hours out in the best corner in town, you know, and I can't ask people for money, and I tell them, you know, I tell them, you don't want to pay me, do you? And they say no, you know, and they walk away, you know. So I was not very good at that type of thing, and so they told me to work in other areas at this commune. But these people were loaded all the time, and we drank wine all the time. But we were broke. I remember one night we had to drink the bong wine. Now, I don't know if you've ever done that, but yeah, it's bad. Some other sick people here, too, but it's pretty bad. And, you know, we would eat the stems, you know, anything just to get high. And I thought, well, it's time to go, so they took me outside of San Bernardino and let me and my dog off to go hitchhiking back to Colorado, and I had been there for 4 months. I left with $4, and a dog I arrived with $2, and I thought, this was life. I made a profit. Look at me. I'm a free spirit, you know, and I used to snub those people that were going to work in their cars, and I felt like such a free spirit. You know, if I couldn't put it in my backpack, I didn't want to own it. You know, it's just the way I was, and so I ended up back at Colorado, and I walked up to my cabin that I had been living in, and there was somebody else living in there. I mean, I had been gone 4 months, so they had to rent it, I guess. And they were wearing, the man answered the door wearing my dashiki, you know. He was with my favorite coffee cup in his hand, and they were cooking with my utensils, and they were sleeping on my sheets and wearing my clothing. And instead of reacting to all of that, what I said was, excuse me, there's a box of photographs in the corner. I used to live here. And they said, oh, yeah, yeah, it's over there. And I went and I got that box of photographs. And as the door slammed behind me, I thought, why don't you just go get your things? What is wrong with you? Just go ask it for back. It belongs to you. All of this stuff belongs to you. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't turn around. I had no worth to myself as a human being already, and I felt like a worm that day. I remember how I felt, and it wasn't a good feeling, and I went to the Mountain Man Bar, and I got drunk. And I called my mom, and my mom said I could come home as long as I stayed out of my dad's way. And I was the thing that lived upstairs that winter. I come from a non-alcoholic home. You know, they still are non-alcoholic. My sisters, my brother, none of them.
They grew up to be what they wanted to be, and that's what they are. And then there was me, you know. Then there was me, and that winter I stayed out of my dad's way. I remember, you know, brushing him in the hallway, and our shoulders touched, and there was such tension there. And we never looked at each other in the eyes. And we, you know, we wouldn't even sit at the same table and have breakfast together. And that was the Thanksgiving at my grandmother's house that they sat me a place with the children at the card tables. They were afraid of me. They didn't know quite how to handle me. And they didn't know what I was going to say or what I was going to do. And if Sharon could just get off those drugs and meet a nice man. I mean, that's what they were saying. They had no idea that I was a full-blown alcoholic. At this time, my gallbladder had stopped working. I had pancreatitis. And they were treating me for nerves. I was getting Valium from the family doctor. And it was okay to drink, so I went into those taverns in that small town and I drank. And I looked at all of the losers in the bar. And I looked at all of them every night, you know, thinking they would be losers, and they're in here every night. Look at them, you know, and I'm in there judging them. And I was lonely, and I was sad, and I was sick, and I was arrogant. And I remember getting on my knees one night as I lived there and asking God to please help me. I knew I was dying, and I had no idea what God sent me was an old high school friend who had an organic farm in northern Wisconsin, and that's where I went off to, was to this organic farm. And they had 50 head of organic sheep. We bought 85 acres of organic land. We had a wood stove. We cooked with wood. If you wanted a cup of tea, you had to chop wood. We made our own wood with a buzzsaw. We made honeybees. We had maple syrup. We tapped maple trees. I remember being stuck out in the snow in northern Wisconsin up to my thighs in snow, because you walk out in the crust with these empty buckets to the maple trees, and they're empty, and you walk on the crust, and then you pick up the sap off the tree and you bring it in, but you get stuck because you sink through the crust. And I remember being stuck up with these buckets of sap up to my thighs, wanting a drink so badly. And all they had to give me was organic pot to smoke. That's all we did, was just smoke this organic pot. And occasionally, we get to drink some little glasses of dandelion wine that was organic. And I'd wait for people to leave the room, and then I'd steal theirs, you know. It was just terrible. It made me more thirsty every time I saw them bring out that dandelion wine. And one night, I was sitting there smoking this organic pot. And I remember I was reading Mother Earth News. I was sitting in my rocking chair rocking. And Phil was over there in the corner learning to play the banjo with the Pete Seeger record. And he would get to this part, the five string, you have to go bum, titty, you know. And he'd miss the first note, or he'd miss the titty or something, and he'd start the record over. And he kept picking it up and starting the record over, picking it up and starting the record over. And I'm smoking this pot, and I'm rocking in my chair, and the snow's looking heavier as it's coming down, and the cat's flicking his tail, and the dog has its tongue hanging out of his mouth looking at me like, God, do something, you know. I rolled out of that chair, and I got into our car, which was bald tires and a station wagon and a big sun painted on the hood, and I went into Connersville, which was a general store, and they had 2 cheap gallons of wine, and I put down my pennies and dimes and quarters and got the wine, and I felt better just knowing that wine was coming home with me. And I got home and I put that wine on the table, and he went to bed because he had seen me as a drunk and he didn't like me as a drunk, and he was trying to clean me up now. And he went to bed and I had a great time. The cat was happier. The dog was smiling. We had a really good time. And in the middle of the night when he woke up because I was making too much noise, he gave me that look. And I know that there's a room full of people that have seen that look. And I always read that look as, what's wrong with you? You're no good. I always read that look as, why can't you just act differently? How come you can't make it out there? What is wrong with you? And now I understand being in Alcoholics Anonymous and being on the other side of people that I love who drink, I understand it's a look of confusion and compassion and a lot of times love and hurt. But I never read it like that coming from anybody. I always read it as a judgment. And I just put up my one finger and I said, screw you, alcohol is more fun than you. And I eventually got blackballed from that organic community, which was just fine with me. I had some surgery, and they discovered this gallbladder and this pancreatitis, and the doctor looked me straight in the eye, and he said, do you abuse drugs or alcohol? You're too young for this. I was 21 years old, and I said, I'm organic, and I meant it with every bit of my heart. And there were signs. There were signs along the way, but not to me, because I'm rolling. You know, you give me my alcohol, I put on wheels. I put on my backpack, and I go. And they left me alone, and they left me alone with that half acre of organic marijuana I was growing. And that's what I did that summer, was weed that pot patch. And it was 12 feet tall bushes by the time I harvested it. It took me 3 days, and I did it right with the boiling water, and I had it all in big hefty bags, and I drove into Menominee to turn my dope deal and get out of town. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm leaving. That's all I know, is I'm leaving. And I forgot the pot back at the farm. So I joined the carnival because it was there, you know? It was just there. And they said to me, maybe your best thinking got you here, Sharon, when they heard that story. And they said, maybe you should just kind of come our way for a while. And they would remind me, these people in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I didn't make good decisions. But at the time, it was the best decision. You know, I took the pot with me. I hadn't sold it, so I was selling it on the road now, you know. And I joined this carnival, Matt Armstrong shows, and I became the shooting gallery girl. And, you know, I had my bottle out there, and my dog was starting to bite people, and my cowboy boots were back on, and people didn't like me very much. And I like to start fights. That's what I do. And we could leave town. You're in town 2 or 3 days, and you're gone. And I would leave all that behind me, I thought. But the baggage was getting heavier. I didn't understand the emotional and spiritual baggage that I was carrying. It was getting heavier. And I met him, and he seemed to have a lot of potential, and he had a pet skunk, and he was very interesting, and the skunk and the dog never got along. It should have been a clue, you know, from the beginning. But we were somewhere down in Bogalusa, and one day opened the door at 6 in the morning. There was a beating on the door, and I opened the door, and it was some of the parish finest down there in Franklinton Parish, Louisiana. And somebody had fingered us, and because I had started another fight on the Midway and gotten us closed down in Monroe, and the owner of the show was not very happy about that. And they fingered us, and they took us off to jail, and the carnival left town without even a goodbye. And there I was in jail with this guy, and he was in jail, and the skunk's in jail, and the dog's in jail. We're all in jail. And they got me for sales and possession, and it was a felony, and it was they didn't understand. It was just my personal use. I wasn't selling it. They didn't care. They wouldn't give me my rights. They wouldn't give me my phone call. They just gave me grits every day. They gave me grits after grits after grits. I won't eat grits to this day, but finally I got my phone call, and I called somebody in New York, my brother-in-law, who was an attorney, and I didn't know this, but he had called my father, and about a week later they came and they said I had a visitor, and they put handcuffs on me, and they took me to this building, and there was my dad sitting there at this attorney that he had hired at his office. And I walked in, and my dad and I couldn't look at each other. There was such pain that day, I remember feeling that, God, Dad, all I want to do is tell you I'm sorry, and let's just go home and start over. But I couldn't look at him, and he couldn't look at me. And we sat there in front of this attorney that day, and my father and I have talked about this. My dad said the only thing you told me all day was that you weren't guilty. See, I was never guilty. It was your fault. I was beginning to live my life as a victim. I had no choices left anymore. King alcohol had taken away my choices. And my dad went home, and this attorney took his money, and the bail bondsman took his money, and finally, after 31 days, they cut me loose and said, don't leave the state because you're going to probably do some time, and maybe you'll pay a fine. We're not sure yet, but just stay in touch. And so me and this boyfriend and the skunk and the dog moved down into the French Quarter of New Orleans, and I fit right in. I fit right in. I got a job dancing at the 500 Club on Bourbon Street, and he got a job as a barker who called people in. And many days I walked down to work with that pet skunk on a leash, and my platform shoes and my short red dress and my fishnet stockings and my platinum blonde wig and my makeup that was just been done by my best friend, the drag queen. And I would walk down Bourbon Street to go to work, and people would look aghast at me. And I loved it. They weren't sure what I was. And I wasn't sure what I was. So I felt really at home in that kind of a get-up, you know? And I danced on that baby grand, and I remember I'd get my fishnet stuck in the props, and then I'd have to pull them off the props, and then my leg would just kind of seep out the hole in the fishnets, and I fell off the piano a couple of times onto the patrons, and I asked for a raise, because that's what you do, you ask for a raise. And they fired me. I ended up learning to tend bar, which came very quickly and very easily to me. And I tended bar in the French Quarter. And this boyfriend, my true love of 2 years, went and worked tugboats. And I kind of get the days mixed up as to when he's coming home, 3 days on, 5 days off. I got real mixed up, and he'd come home, and he didn't want to meet Captain Gill, the one-armed sea captain who can sing to have and to have not. You know, he didn't want to meet him at 3 a.m. in our place, and the fist fights would start, and you should have seen Gill swinging with one arm. That was pretty good. And the knife would come out, and then I'd have to go get a knife. And we lived above a biker bar, and those guys got tired of coming up and breaking it up. They started just calling the police, you know. It was just a sorry, sorry situation. And my parents came to visit me in that condition. They had come to Texas and thought they'd drive over and try to find daughter number two. And see if she's still kicking and alive, and they found me living above this biker bar in this tar paper roof apartment that was filthy, and there were skunk droppings everywhere, and this boyfriend met my father and put the snake in his face upon meeting him, and they tried to take us out to eat, and my mother cried in her baked potato, and this guy called me four-letter words that weren't dear in front of my mother, and it just wasn't something they had in mind for me as I was growing up, lighting up their life, you know, and I remember when they left that day, I wanted to just crawl in the back seat of their car and just go home, cover up with my mom's sweater, and just go home. I was tired. I was so tired of living the way I was living. But I knew nothing would change. I knew absolutely nothing would change. And I didn't know alcoholism. I had no idea. I just thought I was a bad person, and this is my lot in life. This is what's supposed to happen to me. And I felt like the victim. And I didn't see my parents again until sobriety from that day. And I quit calling home, and it was just too painful. And I know that if I can never, ever repay Alcoholics Anonymous for what you have done for my mom and dad. Because my mom can sleep at night, and when I see my dad, there's a twinkle in his eye. I didn't want to do this. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me my family back. But that day, there was no hope going at all. And this guy's parole got pulled, and I should have been happy, but I followed him to St. Louis. Big mistake. I finally found him, and he got off his Harley, and he took off his helmet, and he cracked the window of the car where I was and pulled me up on my hair and said, if I ever see you again, I'll kill you. And then I knew the relationship was over. That's the way I let go. I told my second sponsor, thanks honey, I told my second sponsor that story, and she said, you remind me of the girl with the magic gift in her hand that she just clutches so tightly that she never ever will let us look in her hand to see what she's holding. And one day after getting to know this person, having her come to enough meetings, you begin to trust someone, especially another woman. And this other woman can kind of peel back the fingers one at a time to see what you're hiding and protecting and clutching. And I look in her hand, and I see a turd. I see a turd. You're hanging on to a turd. And I don't know about you, but I felt like my pride was injured at that moment. I pulled myself up by the bootstraps. I looked her square in the eye. I said, I know, Jenny, but it's my turd. And that's all I had going in my life was a turd. I went back to New Orleans, and I began to die a little bit more. The jobs I began to get were on lower and lower and lower parts of the tourist, the tourist brochure. I ended up on Lower Decatur Street, which is not your top tourist attraction of the French Quarter. And I tended bar there, and I got fired. That was the last job I ever tended bar at. I got fired for having a bad attitude because I didn't like to dance with those sailors for a dollar and have a drink with them. And even my friends in New Orleans were beginning to look at me funny, you know. And I would sit there, and I would have I remember working one Mardi Gras. I had 14 shots of tequila lined up because that was my drink, was Jose Cuervo Gold. And being on the Harley today, I don't know about you, but I heard Father Bill talk, and he talked about his martini and what your drink sounds like. I thought, God, what? You know, his drink sounded clinked in the glass, and the ice cubes and the martini and all that sound. And I thought, yeah, I didn't have that kind of drink. What did tequila sound like? And then I was lying there one morning, a couple weeks later, and about 5 in the morning, Bill up the block on my street started his Harley, and it just went vroom, and it just woke the whole block up. And I thought, that's what tequila sounded like, you know, was kick-starting a Harley. But my jobs were becoming lower and lower. As I said, that last job I had, they didn't want me back anymore. And I worked that Mardi Gras, and I had 14 shots of tequila lined up, and I had a quart and a half I had already been through on my shift, and nothing was happening. I was clear as a bell. I could have done the sobriety test at that moment, the field test. And I thought, what is going on? That's a lot of booze. And my head was clear as a bell. And then there'd be other times I'd be sitting at my favorite bar with 2 days off, and Billy the bartender would be on, and I loved the Bastille. It was cold and it was dark, and you could live in there for days. And I took care of him at my bar, so he took care of me at his bar. I had a tab. He put my purse under the bar. He'd let me pass out and come to, and pass out and come to. You know, and I was sitting there with a couple of shots of tequila, and my face is on the bar. And I didn't understand that. And my blackouts were getting more trouble. I was getting in situations where, you know, I remember coming to having a chug-a-lug contest with green chartreuse with the chosen few, which wasn't really my idea of fun in a blackout. And, you know, the people I was hanging around with began to become a little bit more violent. And I was doing that to myself in the blackouts. And I thought, you know, I must not really like myself very much. I remember thinking that. But I had no choice. I had no choice. In 1975, I went to Florida, and I don't remember going. And I remember coming to, driving the wrong way on a freeway with a carload of screaming people that I didn't know. I would come to with blood on myself and not know or remember what had happened. And I'd be between a car and a curb somewhere in the French Quarter. I'd be half in and half out my door and not know if I was coming or going. And I was beginning to not care. You know, there was no more Lauren Bacall in that back bar mirror. I didn't have any more dreams of becoming another George O'Keefe. You know, they were gone. Those dreams were gone. I just had to drink. And I ended up, Mardi Gras day, my friend was shot and killed 2 feet outside the door, my friend Michael. And I don't know why he had a gun that day, but I was in and out of a blackout, and he had a gun, and he was shooting at people off of my balcony, and the police were called, and we were having a party. And I was the last person to talk to Michael alive, and I don't know what I said to him. All I know is that when I came to, the shots were being fired, and he was lying there dead 2 feet from me. And I remember closing the door and saying, I'm taking a bath, and that's the way I dealt with it. And the police came, and I had to go down and be interrogated by homicide, and I was very, very drunk, and they would come in and say terrible things about me and walk out of the room. And I remember nothing would come out of my mouth. I needed some more alcohol, and they wouldn't give me any. I ended up going to my sister's in New York and having a nervous breakdown in her back room. All I could do was drink and read. I just drank and read. I couldn't leave her back room. And I met some people writing a book, and they ended up wanting a sketch artist. And so I came along, and we were all alcoholic, and we saw a lot of drunk Indians is what we went looking for. We didn't go to the reservations to sketch the baskets and to sketch the pottery and to talk to these people. We just met them in the bars and drank. And we ended up in Southern California at a bar called Barney's Beanery one night. And yeah, somebody knows that bar. And it's a sick place, Sarah, isn't it? It's a very sick place. But you know, what's great about it is that's where I met my Eskimo and Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember this girl, Chris. She was so nice to me. And she was drunk one day with me sitting there at the bar. And then all of a sudden she took this book, which was this black big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had said, you know, the bartender said, you're too drunk to drive. You're meeting Chris. We'll call you a taxi. So she went up drunk to this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I remember giving her a cheer out the door with my rock glass full of tequila, and that was the end of it, I thought, you know. And Chris was there for me when I needed her. I came back to New Orleans. My friends wouldn't speak to me anymore, and I said, screw this town. And I met somebody going to Hawaii and had DTs somewhere in Texas. And when we got to Southern California and I showed him my bar, Barney's Beanery, he left me there. And I still haven't made it to Hawaii. I'm waiting to go. But what happened was I got on the back of a Harley that night because I like bikes, and these guys asked me to go, and so we went to Palm Springs. And when we got to where we were going, they started to leave, and I said, hey, I thought we were going to party. And they said, nah, we just need a little extra weight for the back tire to come out here. We're going to leave you here. We looked around the bar and found the fattest one, and it was you. So thanks a lot. See you later. And that's what I had become, was the fat lower companion for Harley-Davidson riders. So I was 170-plus pounds. I don't even know. I was in size 16, size 18 jeans. I was full of bloated mess. I was toxic, and I was ill. And it wasn't from eating chocolate cake. They left me at this bar. I met two new bar boys, I guess. I don't remember. I just remember coming to somewhere at some apartment. I didn't know where I was, and they seemed to be kicking me in the face with their boots. And I had been in that situation before, and I had always been able to get out of those type of situations. But tonight, this night, I didn't care. I just gave up. I said, who the hell cares anyway? You know, they raped me, they broke my jaw in three places, they broke my nose, they drug me around in the cement trying to get me to the car. I was so full of scrapes and bruises when that I was found, they didn't know that I was a Caucasian. And they took me outside of town and they rolled me off the side of the road where you would not have seen me if you drove by. And I heard the car door slam, and then I heard a voice, and the voice said, get up, I want to live. And I was lying face down in the sand. It was July 27th, 1975. I was bleeding from my face. I had no clothes on. I had a concussion. I was in a blackout. I should have just baked. And I heard a voice. The voice said, get up, I want to live. And I believe it was my higher power getting my attention. When there was nothing left for me to do, I could listen. And I heard that voice. I didn't know that at the time. I just know that it made me come too. And I listened to that voice and I paid attention and I crawled up the side of that road and I walked it down some blacktop road and passed out a foot away from the pool at somebody's condominium because I couldn't rouse them, I guess. The gardener found some blood stains and he found me lying there a foot from the pool and he called the police. And there I was in this hospital that morning, July 27th, 1975. And I couldn't talk, and they were prepping me for surgery, and they asked me who had done this and where I was, and this wasn't going to happen in their town, and they seemed concerned about this. And they had gotten my statistics off of my driver's license, and they started to, they found things thrown out on the road, my clothing and my purse and things. And they were asking me these questions, and I was writing because I couldn't talk. And I remember seeing a word on that clipboard that made my heart stop, and the word was victim. And I thought, God, they finally know. I was like, Jesus, they finally know. That's what I am. I am a victim. And they took me into surgery that morning, and there happened to be one of the best plastic surgeons in Palm Springs there checking on one of his paying patients, and he decided to put my face back together. And so my scars don't show, and I am put together not as a crooked person. I feel really blessed. I didn't even realize what a blessing that was until years later. I've gotten my nose broken. This is sober softball so many times. I finally had to have that fixed. But he could have cut me across the middle of my face because I was so bloated that they couldn't tell where my bone structure was. I couldn't touch my cheekbones for almost a year. They were so close to being shattered. And then I was lying in that hospital knowing, because that voice came back, that it wasn't my dad's fault this time. That it wasn't that Catholic God's fault this time. That it wasn't my sister, the Mensa. George, who broke my heart at 18. You know, all my list of woes as to you did this to me. And I knew for the first time that I did that to myself. That I put myself in this situation, but I still didn't know that I was an alcoholic. But I began to hear that it wasn't their fault anymore. And I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks and nobody sent me an airline ticket. You know, it was wonderful. It was, now I can see it was one more airline ticket, you'd have another speaker. You know, Norm Alpe used to talk about seconds and inches. And I knew what he meant when he talked about seconds and inches. And if you think about your life, it's seconds and inches that we get to walk in and sit down to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and know that there's a solution. There are people half a block from here that can't get their hands unglued from a bottle to come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting because they don't even know about Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the lucky ones. We have been given the gift, you know, but it was seconds and inches for me. And if they would have sent me one more airline ticket. I lived above a liquor store in West L.A. waiting for court to happen. They caught these guys, and there I was. Drinking red wine through a straw, through the wires on my mouth where the tooth had been, I'd stick the straw in the red wine and I would suck all day long. And there was no more warmth or fun in alcohol. I just didn't want to see the spiders, so I drank it. I just paced myself all day long. I didn't even care for the taste of it anymore. And I had no choice. I had to stick around and go to court and stick around and go back to these doctors. And besides, I was tired. I was tired. And what happened to me on August 20th was I called my mother and I said, Mom, I need some money. I said, Mom, I couldn't talk. I need some money. And she said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. I can't even send you $20. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? $20, you'd have another speaker if my mom would have said yes. And I called Chris because she was there. Her phone number was there. You know, and my mom's and I have talked about that day, and my mother doesn't know where she got those words. Because there were nights my mother laid awake waiting for the phone to ring. My mother found out something had happened to me, and she didn't know what hospital I was. It took her 2 weeks to find me. Not 2 weeks, 2 days, I'm sorry. My sister had a call from New York and Iowa to find where I was, what hospital I was in. And then she knew that I was going to be okay, but she had gotten a phone call from someone that said I had been raped and beaten up. But she didn't tell her where I was. For 2 nights, my mother didn't sleep, wondering where I was and if I was going to be okay. And my mom gets to sleep at night. I get to call my mom on Thanksgiving and say, gee, Mom, now how is it that you stuff a turkey without marijuana stuffing? How do you do that, Mom? You've given me the gift with my mother. We get to laugh and joke and have a good time. And she can sleep at night because of you. But my mom said no, and I called Chris, and Chris said, I can't help you, but this woman, Suzanne, can. And Chris got me to Alcoholics Anonymous because she knew I belonged here because she was one of us. Chris died at 30 years old. She didn't make the program. She didn't ever get any time together. Reminds me a lot about my friend today I saw. Chris was in a wheelchair, 30 years old, and there was no more beautiful young girl there anymore. There was no one home, and she was drooling on herself. And that's the disease of alcoholism. That's how serious it can be. But Chris got me to Suzanne, and Suzanne said, okay, now put your drink down and put your pot down. And I thought, how does she know I have both? She read my mail instantly, she got my attention, and she sent two beautiful California girls to come pick me up, and I hated them immediately. As soon as they got out of the car, I hated their smiling, clean faces. There I was with my broken Pilates, my broken jaw, my crooked face, my unwashed hair, my unwashed body, jeans were torn, T-shirt had bleach stains, and I'm wondering, what do they want from me? You know, I've got the arrogance to think they're going to take me for something here. And they put me in the back of this Volkswagen, and they were sincere because there's no windows that roll down in the back of a Volkswagen, and they seemed to talk incessantly about themselves. And then we go to this church, and I thought, well, here we go. I've been there before. You know, they're going to want to do something to me forever again. And I didn't like those forever eternity places. I always ran screaming from them. And I walked up to the door with these girls, and there was a man standing there, and he looked nice, and he had a tie on, and I thought he was going to give me the potential test, you know, take me in the kitchen and ask me what I've done with my life. And instead of giving me a judgment, he stuck out his hand, he smiled at me, and he says, a word that made all the difference in the world. Because nobody had said that word to me in a long time, and the word was welcome. And I wasn't ready for that. And they brought me into this meeting, and they sat me down front, and they seemed really proud of me. I tell you, you could walk in the door that night and know there was a new ripe one there in the room. You could smell it. And I think the sicker you are, the prouder they are of you, you know? We don't get to see them come in like that much anymore because it's all treatment centers and people go and get cleaned up and then they come in here and it's, you have 15 years and oh, 2 weeks and you've done your fourth and fifth step. Oh, good, you know. That kind of scares me. And, you know, George was talking about it a little bit today, and then I'm just going to get a little bit on my soapbox and then sit down because I don't know if my son will ever need Alcoholics Anonymous, but I hope if he does, he finds what I found walking in the doors. Because what happens is we water it down when we sponsor people if we don't sponsor them exactly like we were sponsored. You know, with the principles and the traditions and the primary purpose of one alcoholic talking to the other. And I hope that if my kid ever walks in here, he finds the 12 steps just as they are of Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody sticking out their hand saying, welcome. You know, I sat there and they seemed to just be happy I was there. I didn't understand. They gave me the 20 questions, a man that looked like my grandfather Wesley, that I never got to make amends to, who had died. And he looked like my grandpa. I thought, well, I'll be nice and answer these questions for this man. And I passed with 17 and made his night. You know, he was so happy to have me sign all those yeses, check all those yeses. And I don't remember anything that was really said or done. I just remember them trying to push this big blue book, and I thought they were going to go as black then, you know, and I thought they were going to sprinkle me with holy water and that was going to be it, and they didn't do any of that. The speaker that talked said one thing I remember. He said that he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. And I identified, because I had looked for the mothership for years growing up in the Iowa skies. And I knew he knew how I felt just from that woman. And then they whisked me away, and I was living over this liquor store, and their sponsors had told them, I didn't know this, that they should wait for the liquor store lights to turn off before they sent me upstairs. And there was another 2.5 hours we had to sit there, and I had to listen, because I had this broken jaw. I couldn't talk. The first 3 months I was here, I couldn't talk. I had to learn to listen. You know? And I learned to listen, and I am so grateful. I didn't have to stick the cotton in my mouth or my ears. It was done for me. And so we would sit there. Every time these people would take me home, I didn't know why they would sit there forever and talk to me, but their sponsors had told them, wait for the liquor store lights. You know, there's a lot of old-timers in my group that still to this day that are there, that are active, and they remind me occasionally of how it was, and I hope that I never forget. You know, I hope that I'm always involved in a group of people, that there are people down there walking ahead of me, like the number of people that stood up for over 30 years tonight was incredible. You know, please don't stop coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Please keep that path lit for me. And the old-timers had told their babies to come work with me because they were hoping I was going to make it, but they were hoping they didn't have to get too involved. That's what I heard later on. And this woman that I went to visit today, Janann, was one of those women that took me everywhere and drug me around to meetings and took me home and talked to me forever. And then when I got kicked out of the liquor store, I went and stayed with her for a while, and we slept at her son's house and got him evicted. And then we went to his daughter's house and almost got her evicted. And I remember I slept in a hallway for a while, but I had this borrowed sleeping bag in my paper bag of mismatched clothing, whatever was left in my life, and this big book. And that was how I started Alcoholics Anonymous. And I detoxed in that sleeping bag. All I did was pull that sleeping bag up to my nose. They said, try to read 3 pages of that book a night. I couldn't do it. I couldn't read anymore. My mind was gone. I tried. What did I just read? I couldn't remember. But they said, it's okay. Just read the black. Just read the black prints. And so I tried to do that every night. And I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I raised my hand as a newcomer because they helped me do that. And all of a sudden, there I was, 30 days sober, not raising my hand anymore. I thought, how did this happen? I used to beat my fist on the bar saying I'm an alcoholic and hurry up with my drink. You know, that's what I thought an alcoholic was just get me served faster in a bar. I had no idea that I didn't even crave a drink for 30 days. It was really God's grace. I mean, I can't mess with that, boy. That was God's grace, because I wanted to drink all the time. I didn't wait to drink. I drank all the time, and nobody stopped me. And there I was, not missing a drink, 30 days sober. I thought, this is odd. This is very odd. You know, I had a lot of thoughts. I wasn't talking yet. I had a lot of thoughts going. And then they pushed a sponsor on me, and this woman seems to be really happy about this situation, but she was very short. She was half Mexican, half Indian, and Janet was pretty crazy. And she wore these, like, I don't know, she would wear, like, pink shoes and orange socks and a yellow bow in her hair and a plaid up here and stripes down below. And she used to embarrass me, even my condition, right? And I used to... But the neat thing, she was a short little girl, and I could always find her in a crowd. I just looked for the hair bow or the shoes, you know. I could always find her in a crowd. And Janet was an angry girl who had learned how to get a handle on her anger and how to have a life started in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know I was so angry. And she motivated me with my anger. I remember after I got the wires off, they made me go to work, and they wouldn't let me tend bar, and so I had to go be a food waitress, and I was so mad about that. And I just thought, you know, that's beneath me. And I went out there, and I wouldn't, they'd ask me how I was, my customers, and I'd tell them, you know. And nobody wanted to sit in my station anymore, you know. I wasn't making any money. And then one night they showed me how to do the Al-Anon smile, you know. We tried that for a while before I had to go off to work at the graveyard shift. So I went off to work, and I'll show them it doesn't work. And I did this all night long. And I didn't talk to people. They said, how are you? I said, fine. And I give them a smile, one of those Al-Anon smiles. And you know what? By the end of that night, I had like three times the amount of tips I had had in the prior month I had been working there. And I thought, well, maybe these people kind of know what's going on here. And I called them one morning and I said, I just worked the split shift. Now I have to go to the morning. And it's 6 o'clock in the morning and I have the brain tumor and I'm staying home. And she said, first of all, don't wake your sponsor up at 6 and whine. That was the first mistake I made. You know, don't do it. She said to me, she said, fine. She said, if you die at work, we're going to give you a wonderful AA funeral with flowers. We're going to say great things about you. But if you die at home in bed, there's no funeral. And she slammed the phone down in my ear. Well, she made me mad. Yeah. I thought, I'm going to go off to work and do everything she told me, exactly 100% right, so I can call her up at the end of my day and say, you were wrong. I did everything right, and I still had a bad day. But what happens when I turn my judgment over to somebody who's not emotionally involved with me in my head, and they tell me the actions to take instead of, oh, dear, when you feel better, we'll do this, you know? If you have a sponsor telling you that, this is an opinion. I don't know about you, but I needed to act my way into good living. That is freedom for me today, is that I know how to act, you know? My mind still is not my friend, and if I listen to my mind, I'm in trouble. I know how to show up and say fine thank you to my boss. I know how to be on time. I know how to give him a good day's work. And I, you know, and they think I'm great. They have no idea what they've got working at that law firm, I'll tell you. No idea. But Janet taught me those things. Just show up and shut up, you know, and commitment. I mean, people in my group died for commitments. I remember my friend Junan that I went to see today. She taught me a lot about commitment. She was the cookie girl. And my first commitment was washing the cups. That's all I could handle at that meeting. And she and I used to always go out and pick out the cookies, you know, and I used to, if I liked you that night, and I liked that old-timer smiled at me nice, I'd pick out his cookies, you know, or if you had been mean to me, I wouldn't pick out your cookies. And I had a lot of fun with that for a while, but this one night, Janine wouldn't let me go pick out the cookies with her anymore. I don't know if somebody complained or something, but she went out and got the cookies, and then we didn't see her, and we thought, well, it's almost meeting time. She's always back with the cookies. What's going on? And all of a sudden, the LAPD pulls up, and this big, beefy, macho officer gets out with these two bags of cookies and brings the cookies into the meeting. We said, well, where's Junan? He said, well, she's in the back of the car. She was arrested for shoplifting candy bars. You know, she had bought the cookies with the money from the meeting, but she had shoplifted candy bars. But this woman convinced me to bring these cookies to the meeting. And I learned something about commitment that night, you know. But I got involved in service work, and there I was, you know. I was 3 months sober and working, and life got better, and then I was 6 months sober, and I got a car, and I got a driver's license, I got insurance, I got a $24 a week room, I wasn't sleeping on floors anymore, I got my own telephone, I got my first obscene phone call, I got a teddy bear, I was like at home, you know. I was really happy with the simple things in life. Really happy with the simple things in life. And sometimes when it gets so complicated, I just, God, keep it simple. You know, it works so good when you just keep it as simple as that. And it was real simple for me, and I'm so glad because I couldn't have handled anymore. And my life just started for me. Janet and I, she explained to me how I'd done the first step by raising my hand and turning my will and my life over to her, she said, and second step. I didn't go back to New Orleans and get my clothes, so I believed in her judgment over mine, and I let the insanity pass. I didn't believe it would pass, but it did pass. I remember sitting in the meetings, hanging onto the seat with both hands, because I just wanted to run screaming out of there. And I would just sit there and hang onto the seat. And that passed. You know, it took about a week or two, but that feeling passed, and she was right. She said, now it's time for step three. And we went into her house. Her children were running in and out. The curtains were open. We got on our knees and read this third step out of the book. And, you know, I don't feel anything. We're sitting there. She's got her arm around me. And then we get up, and she's so elated. You know, she gives me this long hug. And she was this little girl. And she just leaned up and gave me this long, long hug. And that felt good. I liked that. And then I thought I was gay after that happened. I didn't know. I got so confused with unconditional love. I didn't know what it meant at all. And there I was, emotionally involved in my first year after, not with her, with a man. Something happened, and this man walked in my life, and he had 6 more months than me, and he was nice to me, and nobody had been nice to me in a long time. And I fell hook, line, and sinker for that. And we were friends, for a long time, and then we began a relationship. And then we were in service work together, and then we were at meetings together, and we did a lot of AA together, and then, you know, I was 11 months sober, and then I was going crazy. I was just going absolutely crazy. And she said, you better finish your fourth step before you're a year sober, because all my peers had done it. I don't know about you, but I have a group of peers. You know, I hope you have a group of peers. My friend Pat, she came into the group, and her husband was dying of cancer, so she cried. She came in 8 days after me and got all the old-timers' attention right away from me, you know. And I really resented her for that, you know. And they seemed to like her better than me. She smelled better, I know that. It took me a long time to learn to bathe, but she smelled better. And I didn't like Pat, because she finished her inventory when she was like 4 months sober or something. And every time they seemed to reach after five, she seemed to turn around and give me a little thin blue-lipped smile. That I've done mine. I know you haven't done yours. And she made me so mad, you know. And there I was at the airport one night, 11 months of sobriety, just craving a drink. The craving had come back. And I said, I'm going to go have my slip. I thought I'd call my sponsor. I'm leaving town. Don't worry about me. I'm going to go have my slip. You know, and I was on the phone with her, and she said, well, be like my friend Stella. She wouldn't finish her inventory either. She went out and had her slip at 11 months, and she burned up in a bed. Go have fun, you know. And besides, you'll have less time than Pat, you know. And she made me mad. And I went to that coffee shop, and I bought a piece of pie and a cup of coffee and a notebook, and I had a pen, and I started to write because she made me so mad. And the anger was stronger than the fear. And I wrote, and I got over it that night, and I got through it that night. And I go to the airport to write every inventory still to this day. It just works for me. It just works for me. And I called her up, and I said, okay, I've done it, and I didn't go. And she said, good, we'll do the fifth step. And so a week before my first birthday, we did this fifth step. And nothing wonderful happened. I remember we were out on Venice Beach all night, and we came home, and the sun was coming up, and I remember thinking, well, she shared back with me some of her stuff, and I guess we're not so different, and no big deal, you know. And I went home, went to bed, and that night I went to a meeting, and as they're reading chapter 5, they get to the fourth and fifth step, and I wait for Pat to turn around and look at me with her thin blue lips, you know. And I did, and I gave her a big smile, you know, because I had done it. And I felt like I deserved my seat more in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous kept me here long enough to work through one of the biggest fears in my life, which was sharing me with you, especially another woman. And I thought you'd throw me away, and you didn't. And I felt like, wow, we did something that was pretty big accomplishment. And I got just a drop of self-worth in that empty glass of mine. You know, my glass is full today from just drops of self-worth. You know, it's a spiritual day when I get up and go to work and I don't want to be there, and they're all looking at me funny. I get a big drop of self-worth for showing up and having a good attitude, you know, because it's just the way it is, you know. I can lie at home in bed with my head and listen to them and be insane, or I can suit up and show up, and I've taught myself how to do that here. You just put your feet on the floor, you put your clothes on, and you show up. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me those secrets to life that I was missing in third or fourth grade when they gave them out. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to be a viable human being and a citizen in this society. I vote so I can complain. That's what I was told by my friend Marianne. If you want to complain, you better go vote. So I like to complain, so I went and I vote. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me all of that. I didn't have a clue as to how to even wash my own hair when I got here. I had forgotten all of that. And I got married at 2 years of sobriety, and I hadn't done my sixth or seventh step yet because they were all his defects of character. I don't know about you, but they seemed to be his. And I remember the night that I discovered anger, and I hit him on the head with the flashlight, picked the flashlight up from his head, and he went, "What are you doing?" I said, "I think I'm angry," you know, and it was like it connected for the first time. You know, I'm going to go call my sponsor. I found that I'm angry. It's like we've been waiting, you know, but I connected it. Yeah. Chuck C. used to talk about you don't see till you see, and you don't hear till you hear. And that's what I know today, what he means by that. I didn't understand that man when he talked all the time. And then he would laugh, and I would go, "What is he talking about?" He used to talk in these contrary terms all the time, but everybody wanted to go, "Oh, here, Chuck C," you know. But I always felt good in his midst, in his presence. Even if you're speaking another language, when I come into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's something that happens when two or three alcoholics are gathered together that I can't manufacture at home alone. I hope that I'm still remembering to show up at Alcoholics Anonymous if I ever get to be an old woman. I hope that I still come because it happens here. It always rejuvenates me. It's where I can come in and lick my wounds and go out in a world I still don't understand and do it one more day. And I can come here and be with you. You're my family of understanding. You know me inside and out. You know me better than any of my relatives ever. Yeah, I don't call up my mother and say, "Gee, Mom, you know, I've got flying figured out now. You just don't wear any polyester. You wear cotton because polyester sticks to you when you burn. So you just, you know, I have this terrible fear of lying, you know." I don't call up my mother and make her worry with thoughts like that, you know. But I can talk to you about it. We can have a good laugh. You understand? And there we go. I can get on an airplane, you know. And I didn't have a higher power going for me for a long time. He was my higher power. My sponsor walked by me one night when I was sharing with all the newcomers I was working with and said, "You better get your own higher power. You're going to get drunk." And she walked by and she made me mad. What does she mean, embarrassing me in front of these people that think I know something? You know, so Beacon's moving van drove by right at that moment. I said, "Come here, Janet. Look, Beacon's, that's my higher power." She said, "Good, as long as it's not you." And she turned on her heel and she walked. Well, I thought I'd show her. I prayed at Beacon's for a long time, you know. And I prayed to Beacon's moving van. That was my God, was Beacon's. And I don't know about you, but I see them everywhere these days. They're just all over the place. I can be in another state, and there goes a Beacon's truck right by me, and I can take a deep breath and know I'm going to be okay, you know. My son points them out on the road as we're having an intense discussion. "Look, Mom, there's Beacon's. Remember God, you know. He's getting pretty smart." But it didn't matter. I started to hit my knees. I started to hit my knees. And I felt empty about that for an awful long time because I was so afraid of that Catholic God, you know. And I had just had to let go of all that stuff. I got married, and my dad came out to the wedding, and I had made my written amends, and I had done that, and I had done a few financial amends, and we were on our way there, and my dad walked me down the aisle, and my mother was here, and my sisters, and they looked at all of you, and they said, "My dad said, you know what, Sharon? Look at your life. You've got it made." And I thought, God, he's giving me approval. Is the earth going to shake now? And what happened was I knew I already had my own approval. I knew that I was in the right place, and it was like icing on the cake. And my dad and I had still some hard times being together, and I would go home and visit, and it was still tense at the table together, and we couldn't really look each other in the eye, and I didn't know what that was. I didn't know that that was called guilt. I got another sponsor at 5 years of sobriety, and we went over the steps again. And Ginny had me make some financial amends to my father. And I thought, well, how do you know I owe him any money? What is this, you know? It wasn't in my inventory. What are you thinking? And she said, call him up and ask him how much you owe him. And I thought, well, okay, I'll call him, but he'll take him a couple of days to get back to me. Wrong. My dad had a number ready for me. I think he had gone home, he had picked up the big book, he had gone home, and he had run a calculator tape one night, you know? And he said, if Sharon calls, give her this bottom line. And I ended up resenting that, but I called Ginny, and I said, he's too quick with it, and it's too high. She said, I don't care. You know, he's probably giving you a break. And she said, well, what can you afford? And we talked about it. She said, good. Call him in 2 days and ask him if those terms are okay. And tell him you're going to send him a check every month. So I thought, good, in 2 days he'll mellow out a little. And he'll start remembering that you know, he didn't send me to Europe like the rest of the children. And I paid for most of my own wedding. And you know, he didn't buy me a car, he just took a couple, you know, and he didn't have to finish paying for my college because I never finished, and but I called him and he accepted my terms. And I called her back and I said, he accepted. She said, good, you do not send that check late. You are an example of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and maybe the only example he'll ever see. And you send that check on time every month. And she said, are you really willing to grow through this? You know, they wait. They wait for you to get a little bit weak. And then they say, okay, just one more thing, you know? I've always had sponsors that are stronger and louder than my own head. And I am so glad. And I'm so glad because she just knew that there was more to that humility and there was healing on the other end of that. And she pushed me into the healing by having me put a note about my life with that check every month. And I thought, he doesn't care. She said, do it anyway. And I wrote it on little pieces of paper with that check. And then about 6 months later, I don't know how many months later, I found myself picking out a card to put the check in and sending it off. And then it seemed like I was sending too many checks, and I began to get resentful. So I'd start making these psychedelic payment numbers in the left-hand side, thinking he'll pay attention. Then she's overpaying me here. We better cut this out. And I told her I didn't have the money, and she said, send it anyway. He's putting it into a trust fund so that you can buy this Jaguar that you've been wanting, you know. Well, I sent it early for a couple of months, you know. And I just went on and on and on, and the letters seemed to come more freely, and Father's Day cards weren't so hard to pick out, and I could remember his birthday and even pick out a present for him. And we did this for over 3.5 years. And one holiday season, he called me, and my dad never called me. My mom called me, and then my dad got on the phone. And my dad called me, and he says, Sharon, Merry Christmas. I don't want any more of your money. Your debt with me is free and clear. But don't stop sending me your notes. And I got to walk into a guilt-free relationship with my father because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can look him in the eyes and tell him I love him. And he can tell me he loves me too. And I just got back from being back there with him. And he's getting older and needs a new hip and he's kind of crotchety. And he caught this groundhog. And I don't know why I'm telling you this story, but my son was there, and he's just turned 9, and you know, we just saw Groundhog's Day. You can't kill this groundhog, Grandpa, you know. And but, you know, Iowa farmers or the people that work the land, you know, you kind of shoot those things. And but there's this poor groundhog, and so my son and I are going, hey, Dad, how about if we sweep the grass that you just mowed off the driveway if you go give that groundhog some food and water? And he grumble and go, all right. And he went down there and he gave it some food and water. And then it was raining the next day. And we said, Grandpa, that groundhog, he's going to drown. He said, I covered it. You know, he's covered. Don't worry. You know, and we're saying, come on, Grandpa, let us take it 5 miles away and let it go. And he's going, nope, you know, those groundhogs are no good. And my son and I are scheming, you know, we're scheming. And one day we came home and the groundhog was gone. And my son went running up to Grandpa and he said, Grandpa, where's the groundhog? And he said, I let the damn thing go. It was, you know, it was my father's way of loving me and my son. And I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous has opened my eyes to that, because I always expected so much from everybody, and nobody could ever meet my standards, including myself. And I have learned how to let you be a child of God, and I have learned how to let me be God's kid too. And that marriage went on, and things were real good. And we went through the punk rock stage, and he got into that. And I had to go to Al-Anon, and I had to quit burning up his Dead Kennedys albums in the oven because I had to call my Al-Anon sponsors. You say you have to go replace it, and so I just got tired of that. And he was wearing the black hat, I was wearing the white hat. I was starting to sponsor people, and he was going off the flotation tanks. It was really odd for a while, but nobody had to drink, and I walked into my Al-Anon meeting one night, and he was sitting there learning how to release me, and we just burst into laughter, and we started to be friends again. And he came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we began to backpack in the High Sierras, and we got rained in for about 4 days up there in the Snake River, and then we had to just keep the equipment dry. It was just important, because we were pretty high up, to keep the equipment dry, and so we had to spend time in the tent together. And we became friends again. And I got pregnant, and I didn't know how that would happen because I had never gotten pregnant before. That was something new for me. And on June 23rd, 1984, my son was born, and I got to name him after my dead grandfather, Wesley. And he had all his fingers and all his toes, and I was so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that there was a loving God. I had taken hundreds and hundreds of trips of LSD. I had destroyed myself, not just with alcohol, but a lot of drugs. And my son had all his fingers and all his toes. And I was so grateful that day. And I got to be a housewife and a mom and quit my travel agency job and just enjoy. And then on January of 1986, he decided he wanted to leave and not be married anymore. I was 10 years sober, and I was sponsoring a lot of people. And I thought, you know, let me just hang on his leg and be the doormat here and just beg him to not go, because I'm happy with this life. This was really good. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't tell a newcomer that called me on the phone that morning, now look in the mirror 3 times a day and say, I like you, you know, because they told me to do that. And so I'd pass this stuff along. And I couldn't tell her to do that and lay down and be the doormat. I just couldn't do it. I had to stand up and let him go. And it was real hard because I wanted that marriage more than anything. And I found out there was another woman involved, and our group is about, it's about a 1,200 size. It's pretty big now on Wednesday nights, but you can still spot them in the room, you know. And nobody got custody of any of the meetings, the big ones, the small ones, nothing. And it was real painful. She had less time than me, and it made me mad, you know. It made me really, really mad. And I started to hate all of you because I judged all of you because you probably knew this was going on and nobody told me. You know, and I got mad at everybody, and I walked around with a sullen look on my face. My sponsor of 21 years got off a plane with 21 days for smoking pot in Paris. And I had to go get another sponsor, and I had asked Clancy to be my sponsor. And I was so grateful he was my sponsor that year, because he walked me through that year like a total newcomer. I fell apart. I absolutely fell apart that year. Alcoholics Anonymous never stopped calling me and asking me to do commitments. People that wouldn't let me lay at home, pull the covers over my head. I was incapable of working. I was having a hard time being a mother. I wasn't sleeping at night, and at 4 in the morning when I would come to in a fetal position, I would go, get away from me, God, I hate you. Go away, leave me alone. I hate you, God. And God wouldn't go away. I kept going, God, if you just leave, then I could go to Paris and drink some fine wine, you know? But God never left me because I had had a spiritual awakening as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God was right there with me, and it made me so mad. I wanted him to go away so I could go drink, you know? And he just wouldn't leave me. And I came here for 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days, just like that. And my sponsor would have to talk me back into some sort of reality a lot of the time. And I remember the one night that they were happy at that meeting that night. The two of them seemed, you know, they were going to get married, and she was pregnant, and here we go, you know. And it made me mad. They were so happy, and I found myself with 2 hot cups of black coffee because I had heard a speaker talk about people being spiritual with hot coffee on them. And, you know, you hear what you're going to hear, right? So I stopped myself on my way over to the corner of the room where they seemed to be smiling, and I had these 2 big hot cups of black coffee. And it happened to be a Saturday. My sponsor was in town, and he's never in town at that Saturday night meeting. And there's about 500 people there. And he happened to see me and spot where I was headed and look at the look in my eyes. And he caught me halfway. He took the coffee out of my hands. He grabbed me by the shoulders, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace. And if he would have just stopped there, you know what I felt about dignity and grace at that moment? My one finger, you know? But he added something, because they always add something that just makes you hear it, so that you can be an example to the others. I thought, oh, screw this, but you're right. You know, that's what my head said, and I just growled at him, put the coffee down, I went and sat in my seat and probably huffed and puffed the rest of the night. But I heard him, and I started to turn it around, and I started to sponsor more people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was getting some real sick ones at that time, and you know, it was such a joy to be able to get out of my head and work my own steps and quit looking at them. And there I was at their son's first birthday party a year later, you know, at their son's first birthday party, and dishing up ice cream in the kitchen, you know. And there they are, sitting in there with her and her family and him and a few friends, and my son's there. And how'd I get here, dishing up ice cream in their kitchen at their son's first birthday party? I hate these people, you know. I was there mugging for the camera, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to suit up and show up and to learn to get over it. I mean, it was real hard. She and I became very good friends. We meet once a month or so that I can pass my clothing, my son's clothing, along to her son so that the kids can get together, so that we can go to a movie or go have pizza, you know. And we've become marvelous friends. I mean, they've been divorced for a little while, so I think that helps a little bit. But, when her son was a year and a half old, exactly the age my son was, she told me I was her example of walking through it with dignity and grace. You never know who's looking. Absolutely. Never know. Oh, it's been a long road with all of that, but he had a heart attack last May and a year ago. And it was pretty sudden. He found an Al-Anon. I don't know if that did it to him, but no, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Actually, they get along real well, and he's got a great relationship going with her. And he's since found a new sponsor, and he's working the steps at a level I've never seen him work. And he's a good dad to these kids, and we're all friends. It's so strange. But he had this heart attack, and I walked in there with my son, and I told my son he might look funny and be prepared. And my son walks right up and holds his hand, and Cindy was there reading out of the big book. And it really brought some emotion out in me. I hadn't really healed up from all that before. And what I realized was, as I was rubbing the leg cramps out he was having because you've taught me to be of service, that I hadn't wished this man all the joy, happiness, prosperity that he ever wants. And I was able at that moment, because I was being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, to wish him that and to heal. And I felt it. I felt it just like I walked through that 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days, and I was sitting in a Catholic church one day when this marriage was over, 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days later, waiting for the nun I sponsor. Now get that, you know? I get to tell Sheila on a weekly basis, don't worry, Sheila, have faith. It's going to be okay. But Sheila is a wonderful example and a strong woman, and she has brought me back to the church so that I could take my God in there with me. I can go anywhere with my God and I hear peace and love. You know, I used to hear judgment, and I hear peace and love in that church. And I sent my son to that school that she's principal of because he was having a very hard time. He got kicked out of another school, is what happened in kindergarten. And I sent him over there. Yeah, I know. I'm wondering about it, too. So I sent him to that school, but I was sitting in that church and waiting for Sheila that day, and I felt the healing happen. God had pushed me through the other doorway. And I don't know about you, but if one door closes, the other one better open. I'm so impatient, and I want to know what's happening, and it's hard for me. It was talked about yesterday about having not just the faith, but the trust. Just having the trust that it's going to be okay, that whatever it is, there's a beautiful plateau waiting through that next doorway that you've never seen before, that brings you more healing and humility and God's love and just a more beautiful view than you've ever seen. And I have to trust that that's what pain is all about. It brings me through. And it always has, and it always will. But I have to be reminded. I have to come and be with you and meet you in the hallway and ask you what you're doing in the hallway. How's your life? Why do you hurt? And then we can talk about so-and-so that got through the door, because we know our turn's coming. Our turn's coming through that door. And I was waiting for Sheila, and that happened for me. You know, I get to sponsor a lot of women. I remember this one woman that I sponsored, she couldn't tie her shoes. She was so drunk at the first meeting. And then we get to watch her run her first marathon a year later, you know, and cheer her on with her shoes tied. You know, how do you get from there, from no shoes tied, looking at the ground, drunk as a skunk, to running a marathon with your chin up and dignity in your life? It's 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a great relationship with a man in my life. I move slowly. We've been together 6 years. We're still not living together, and that's okay, you know. I have been raising my son, and it's been taking a lot of energy, and I'm very involved in other people's lives in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm just
having a ball with my life. But Casey and I have a great time because we connect of spirit. And people say, you seem to have so much fun together. What's your secret? I say, well, I don't work on my relationship with him. I work on my relationship with God. And that's what it's all about, you know, and we have a great time, and I miss him and I love him a lot. And my son is just turned 9, and he, in second grade, he raised his hand because they were reading A.A. Milne, Winnie the Pooh, and he told everybody about his mom and A.A. in second grade, you know. In nursery school, he used to sing Keep Coming Back at the end of Happy Birthday, and he said, what does that mean, you know? I remember when I'd bring home convention badges, he put on his cowboy outfit, and he put on these kind of badges instead of a regular star badge. He thought those were badges, you know. And he gets to come with me, and Mary Ann and John have met him, and he's just full of life. He's just so full of life. And you've given me that ability to get down on his level and look him eyeball to eyeball, and to do Legos with him, and to read books together, and go out and look for X-Men cards and comic books, and you know, throw a football and hit a baseball with him. And he said to me, Mom, he's great at gymnastics. He said, Mom, can you do a cartwheel? You're too old, aren't you? You know? And so I worked on that in my Iowa vacation, and I worked on that cartwheel, and we got it back down just to the roundup, but he's proud of me. Boy, he says, all right, my mom, she's, you know, she's 43, but you should see her do a roundup, you know. And my kid is because of my relationship with you, I've learned how to have my relationship with him and to see God in his life. And it's hard being a single parent, but you know what? It's really a lot of fun. You know, I just treat him like a newcomer a lot of the time. And we say our prayers together at night, and he thinks about people who have been crying at a meeting. And he'll ask me how they're doing, and he'll say a little prayer for them. He's a sensitive, bright little kid, and I don't know if he's ever going to need you, but I hope that we pass along exactly what was given to us, so that we water this thing down, so that he walks in here someday, you know, like Lindsay, like Lindsay's boy. He'll find the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in act, you know, with those 12 steps. And I'm really just so pleased to be here with you. I know that, you know, my favorite part of the book is called There's a Solution. It talks about having met people in whom the problem has been solved, there was nothing left for me to do but pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at my feet. And you laid those tools at my feet and you said, okay, this is how you're working, but you've got to do the work. And you get the benefits. And I really, literally have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of life that I didn't know existed. I am happy, joyous, and free today. I have defects and I have problems, you know, and I work on my steps 10, 11, and 12 every single day of my life because I can't live on yesterdays. I need God in my life today with me because God loves me today. I know that. And I love you today. Thank you, Atlanta, for loving me. Thank you.